Welcome to Novelist Spotlight, the podcast where published fiction writers are interviewed to gather their insights and writing lessons so we can use them to make ourselves better and more effective writers. There are just three things I ask of you, if appropriate to you and your experience. Please subscribe, please click on the like button, and please share this program link with any family members, friends, or colleagues who might be interested or benefit from the content. Now, on with our program.
Hi, I'm Diana Giovinazzo. I am a historical fiction author with two books, my latest being Antoinette's Sister, and my debut being The Woman in Red. I'm Italian-American, and I live in Los Angeles, California, and I'm also a podcaster myself. I have a podcast called Wine, Women, and Words.
This is Mike Consul, your host, and Diana, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, you're obviously Italian. Wine, Women, and Words. You can't get much more Italian than that. And a lot of people don't know this about me, but because my last name sounds British, but I'm actually a full-blood Italian. My name used to be Consilvio until my grandfather showed up at Ellis Island, and it was truncated. And my mother's maiden name is Sacco. And I even took an Ancestry.com saliva test, and because, you know, you think you're Italian, but you really wonder, how Italian am I? Well, it came out 86 or 87%. All my life I've been saying I'm full-blood Italian, and I feel like I have not been misleading people. Are you Italian on both sides,
Diana? No, I'm half Italian.
Italian.
Yeah.
You look full. You know, people will see your photograph if they're listening to the YouTube version of this podcast, but you certainly look Italian, no question about it.
I look very much like my father and my grandmother, my dad's side. We all have, there's the Giovinazzo traits that are very distinct within our family, from the thick eyebrows to the dark hair. My little brother, who's 14 years younger than me, we thought at first he was going to be blonde haired and blue eyes, and it turns out, nope, he's very much looks like a male version of me in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
So it's kind of weird when you see those filters where you have, hey, you know, you can you date the guy that looks just like you? And when you do those filters, like that are on TikTok, and I look at it, yes, it's like, that's my brother. That's so gross. Whoa.
Well, he's definitely a member of the tribe. So that's not a bad thing. You know, here you are, a writer, a novelist. Mm-hmm. You've got a couple out there. You're working on something else. I know because I listened to in on another interview you did, and we'll get to that later, although I know that you're not going to tell us a whole lot about it. But you almost, well, you did give up writing, mm-hmm, and you came back to the practice. Talk about why you gave it up and how you were led back to being a writer.
So when I was in my 20s, we were living in Texas, and I was fresh out of college, and my husband was active duty military, and I didn't really have a full dedicated daytime job. So I was like, you know what, I'm going to give this writing thing a go. It's something that I've always wanted to do. And I tried it, and I fell flat on my face. I just could not get a book going that was halfway decent. I couldn't even get into any literary journals. I was just struggling, and I was so frustrated with myself that I was like, you know what? I'm just going to give this up. This is not for me. There are some people who are supposed to be readers and others who are supposed to be writers, and I'm clearly going to be a reader. That was my mindset when I was in my 20s.
Let me stop you for a minute and tell me, when you say you fell flat on your face, tell us what happened that made you feel that this was a failure. I fell on my face.
I couldn't get anything published. That, for me, that's what made it feel like I was a failure.
The actual writing, when you were writing, mm-hmm, you felt good about what you were producing at the time, mm-hmm, but you weren't getting other people. You weren't getting the people who counted in your world to salute.
Yeah.
And so you decided, I obviously don't have any skill for this, or they just don't buy into my writing style or what have you.
Exactly. And I feel like it, and at the time I was so focused on it having to be something, just whether it was a literary journal. I was putting out short stories to every literary journal that I could find. I was also doing as many, hitting up any, like, agent I could at the time, just trying to get something going. And I was trying to write fantasy as well. And this is something that I kind of talked to other writers about that are struggling is, you know, I love fantasy. I still love reading fantasy. But sometimes it's good to step back and ask yourself, is this a genre that you should be writing? Is this a genre that's meant for you? And to really just look at that, because I kind of feel like that was one of the things that at the time, fantasy wasn't necessarily the genre meant for me for writing, if that makes any sense. And I think that in a combination of stepping back into reading far more than I was, because I was a reader, I've always been a reader, but going more in depth with my reading, and I think that really helped me become a writer later on. But
so what brought you back to the fold? You fell on your face, mm-hmm. you got all these rejections, you said, I'm a reader, I'm not a writer, you know, apparently. So how did you come back to the practice?
That would be the doing of my co-host for my podcast, Michelle. We're longtime close friends, and we had kind of formed this bond with books. We worked at this really, really crappy job. It was a travel agency for timeshare owners. And we had these cubicles, and we were dealing with people calling in, yelling at us, because they couldn't get the reservations that they wanted, even though we had no control over that at all whatsoever. And
I'm sure you got a short story out of that.
Oh, so many. From the woman who wanted to drive to Hawaii from San Francisco to the guy who would
America, you know, Americans are terrible at geography. Obviously, we don't even understand land masses, I guess. But so the woman wants to drive to Hawaii to the man who wanted to do what?
He used to call us from his bathtub.
He was splashed around with his rubber duck in there, huh?
You could hear it. You could hear the echo, and you could hear the splashing of the bathtub. And he called every time he called, he was in the bathtub. And whenever he called, we put it on speaker, and we would all quiet down so we could listen to this conversation happening. So people listening, please be careful of where you were calling.
Yes, that must have been his call time. He took his bath each day, and that was the time when he made his phone calls.
Yes.
So he could relax a little bit, and yet at the same time, we won't even go there. It sounds creepy to me, a guy calling from his bathtub.
It is very creepy. So Michelle and I had this job, and when we were supposed to be working, we were reading, and we would trade books back and forth. And sometimes I can be a really fast reader. And one time I actually read a book. She handed it to me at 8 o'clock in the morning when I got there. And about 5 o'clock when it was time to leave, I handed it back to her because it was finished. And there was some like short story anthology thing going on with, I don't know if it was a podcast. I can't remember what it was that we were following at the time. But they were doing this contest, and she was like, you should do a story. Let's do a story and write it and enter. And I was like, that's not my thing. I'm not a writer. I'm a reader. And she was like, no, you should. You love books. It doesn't matter. That's stupid logic. And so I was like, well, I don't know. And she's like, well, how about this? You do the story. We'll each do stories, and we'll just trade them with each other. That's it. That's all we'll do. And I was like, okay, fine, we'll do that. And I wrote this story, and it was still fantasy. And it was a nice story. She still remembers the story. It was a story of a girl in a steampunk San Francisco. And she really loved the concept of it. And she was so taken by the story that she was like, you have to turn it in. You have to put it into this anthology. So I did. And of course it didn't win, but she was like, your writing is so good. I don't understand why you're not writing. And we talked about what I was dealing with, and she was just like, well, that's just stupid. And she started saying, well, you need to be a writer. And Twitter, not to date myself too much, but Twitter was still a new thing at the time. And she went even a step further of from going into Twitter, finding articles from people talking about writing and about how you should be writing and how you should make time for your writing. And she would send it to me and tag the author. And then the authors of the stories would be like, yeah, Diana, why aren't you writing? And she just kept doing that until finally I was like, all right, fine. I'm going to start writing again. And I started blogging and soon.
Wow. And then, there's your muse.
Yeah.
So she browbeat you into getting writing again.
She did. Yeah. I would not have the career I have today, really, because it's because of her, because she got me out of that funk.
So you were doing short stories. You were getting rejections. Were you doing short stories because that's what writers are told to do? Start with short stories. And then eventually, you know, once you master that and you get out there and get a name for yourself, maybe then you go on to novels. I mean, we just had a guest recently who said, she argues that writers should not start with short stories. That's bad advice. Mm-hmm. But you went down that path. Lots of people go down that path. So when you reinitiated the writing, when you got browbeaten into it by your podcast partner, did you go straight to the novel? And
yes.
Did you go to
to
the novel?
Yeah,
full length,
mm-hmm.
No holds barred. And then was it historic? Was it The Lady in Red, or was it an ill-fated novel?
It was an ill-fated novel. I tried the NaNoWriMo. I felt like that's a really good way, and I love the advice that your other guest had that. Starting with short stories is really, really bad advice. It really is. So many people do it. They tell you that you need to do it when you go through MFA programs. They say you got to start with short stories. And I feel like a short story isn't good for a new writer, especially when you're trying to work on the pacing and character development. There's so much that goes into it. And a short story is so truncated that you can't really develop that with that. You have to use like a novel, something much longer, even if it's a novella, just to try to play with that. And I love NaNoWriMo.
Now explain that. So that's where it's the full name of it is Novelist Writer's Month or something.
Yes.
You're supposed to write 30,000 words or 30,000 words?
50,000 words in a month. And it's,
did you do it?
I did.
Did you accomplish it?
I did.
You did it.
I did.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Because a lot of people do it every year. I had one of the people I had on the podcast is, God, her name escapes me now, but she's, it'll come to me, but she's, does it every year. And she says, I never hit the target, but nonetheless, it's good for me.
Yeah.
It's good for me.
Oh, yes. It's an excellent exercise. So
I'm thinking of Mer Lafferty, by the way, Mer Lafferty, and I should be writing. Is the name of one of her podcasts. She has two or three, well, actually, I think three podcasts. Anyway, go ahead, Diana.
No problem. Though, what's good about it for me is that it gets you into the habit of writing every day. When it comes to writing, it's building habit, building that exercise kind of momentum where you feel like you should be doing it at least almost every day. And that really helps get you into the habit and gets you past the, oh my God, a novel so long, I can't do it. And it's a really great exercise. The first time I did it, I did not make the full, I didn't win it. I think I got to maybe 30,000 words. And again, it was fantasy, ill-fated fantasy story. And it wasn't until I actually had a conversation with my father about our genealogy that I started writing historical fiction. And that was kind of like a light bulb over my head kind of situation.
So talk about, because you were writing fantasy, you must have enjoyed reading fantasy. You probably felt that you're really unleashed your imagination. Fiction writing, period, is really an unleashing of the imagination. But fantasy in particular, because you're really working with, it's a whole wholly fashioned canvas, really. So how did you end up with historical fiction? You looked into your genealogy, you learned about yourself, your Italian heritage. So how did it happen from there?
So with the Italian heritage, we're always asking the question, well, how did we make it to the United States? Like as you mentioned, your family came from Ellis Island. You know, what brought us here? And it's a question I feel like every Italian asks. And anybody who comes from an immigrant group really asks, how did we come here? And for me, my grandparents had long since passed, and I didn't have those stories to fall back on. And so I was talking to my father, and that question of how we came here changed to, well, why? Why did we come to the United States? What was going on in Italy that caused our family to want to come to the United States? And, you know, we were discussing like the ins and outs of immigration and looking and discussing the things that happen, you know, were going on in like South America with people coming, you know, coming here on foot to the United States and refugees and whatnot. And my father just said, you know, have you heard about Garibaldi, Giuseppe Garibaldi? And he really did a lot for Italy. He's basically their Lincoln. It's like a combination of their Lincoln and their George Washington, really, when you really look at it. And he's like, I really think you would like his wife, Anita. I think that's somebody in history that you would be really interested in. And so I looked at the history, and I felt so engrossed by her history. And I wasn't even finished with her reading her biography that I was like, you know what? I'm going to try my hand again at writing a novel, but I'm going to look at historical fiction. Even though I read a lot of fantasy, I also have read a lot of historical fiction through the years. I was a huge fan of Philippa Gregory, and I was like, you know what? Let's give this a go. And once I started doing that, that's when everything just kind of fell in line.
You know, isn't it something when you're writing about kind of your, you know, your heritage and your, I mean, I've had this experience because one of the manuscripts I've written, which I'm actually in the process of self-publishing, was about my big fat Italian family. And it includes a visit back to Italy as part of a kind of a programming process. But the actual act of doing that and basing it on, in my case, on family members, there's something that is very central about that, something that really kind of gets to your core. I don't know if you had that experience or not with The Lady in Red and also Antoinette's Sister, your second novel. Do you feel that because you're writing about your peeps, that it's got some extra resonance or anything of that sort?
Absolutely. Because for me, even though I'm not related to these two women, my family were not, we were very much Southern peasants, and I'm very proud of that. But my family was affected by these people. My family was very much affected by Giuseppe Garibaldi and the unification of Italy. And my family were Calabrians and Sicilians, and they were under the rule of Maria Carolina Charlotte. So these people really had a huge effect on my family. And that really does, that does resonate so much with me because, you know, my family lived there during this time. My family was affected by these people. And these women and the people in both of these stories were just, it was so amazing. And that time period that they were in was just so volatile for the both of them that it was just, I'm still sometimes taken back by it.
You know, name a writer who inspires you. I know there's got to be many, but just name one.
Oh, gosh. Off the top of my head, I love Jhumpa Lahiri's books and Elena Ferrante. Those are my two big ones.
Elena Ferrante is huge. Mm-hmm. I read her, the story of, it was the one with the, it was her second one, I think, where the girls are into adulthood. And that was a great book. I mean, I really enjoyed that, and it really connects you with Italy and what goes on there. Really holds Italian men in a horrible light. I will say that, probably deservedly so. But yeah, she's a terrific writer. Is there anything that happens involuntarily when you write? Is there something, and it could be a negative thing or it could be a positive thing, but it just happens when you write something that maybe comes out or is repetitious about your writing, or something that's a signature in your writing?
Well, I think one of the things that I do, I think on the plus side, is there's always an Easter egg of where, a family member's name or something that's placed in both of the books as a nod to my family.
So you put an actual name of a family member in there that, that they end up finding and probably being delighted by when they read the book.
Yeah. One of my
That's a conscious thing though,
yeah,
right?
That's a conscious thing. Yeah. I think unconsciously, I think I have my crutch words. I think every author has a crutch word. every writer has a crutch word. And I find I use just way too much and I'm always deleting that.
Do you like search the document for the word just to make sure that you don't, I just use just in my own sentence, just to make sure that you don't, you eradicate, too much repetition.
I find I've noticed it so much that I feel like on the second pass through of the book that it's always I find it and it's like, oh, it sticks out like a sore thumb at that point.
Yeah, I agree. I think there are people, I mean, myself included, where it's a phrase or a word mm-hmm. that you really got to look out for. Mm-hmm. You know, more and more when I talk to people about writing, and we just had the guy who wrote how to write a damn good novel, James Fry, one of the best-selling and my favorite book I've ever read about novel writing. Terrific stuff. But he really emphasizes, and Robert McKee, the famous screenwriter, they all emphasize conflict. Mm-hmm. Don't you, having grown up in an Italian family, you had conflict constantly, right? I mean, I did in my own household. So it's very natural to you, probably. And that's what really drives a story forward. I mean, you know, you and I both being Italian, we're probably screaming at each other before this thing is over. But do you find that... do you agree that conflict is essential to making the story move? And do you find that a natural part of who you are and maybe because of your ethnicity?
Definitely conflict has to be there. It's
because, and I know everybody knows people who run from conflict. Mm-hmm. They avoid it. I'm a person who does not do that. I'm happy to engage in conflict, and you likely are too, just based on how we grew up.
It depends. I try to control myself, and I feel like in trying to control myself, I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to leave. I'm just out. I have a tendency to do that. I feel like over the years, where I'm just like, I don't want to deal with this conflict and this drama. It's part of the reason why I'm on the West Coast instead of New York. So it's, I find that, but I feel like when you're looking at, especially because I write first person narratives, and so from that inner conflict, I think so much of that comes into play with the characters, because you're getting into their thoughts and their emotions and the conflicts that we had inside ourselves, where whether it's something as simple as, did I say the right thing? Did I do the right thing at this dinner or something of that nature, to the bigger things like with Maria Carolina Charlotte, where she's got this conflict within herself of wanting to be a good mother. But yet at the same time, she also needs to be a queen. And so you've got that inner conflict within her, that because those two things don't necessarily match up.
Now, something you mentioned, California or Los Angeles, you live in Los Angeles, something mm-hmm. we have in common, we're both in California, but we both were born, I believe you were born in New York State like I was, correct?
Yeah.
I was in upstate New York, in Endicott, New York.
Okay.
Were you in the city or were you upstate?
I was central New York. I'm originally from the Utica area.
Utica. Mm-hmm. Okay. What brought you to California then? I mean, you said that it really is a really different culture in just the way people kind of are towards each other. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I went to Arizona State University, and when I went there, one of the first things I learned is when you're joking around, you don't bust other people's chops like you do in upstate New York or the Northeast. People really, they recoil at that.
Uh-huh.
It's like, whoa, what's going on here? You see very quickly that, oh, okay, if you're going to make fun, you do it at your own expense or some anonymous person's, mm-hmm. Not somebody else's. Very different culture in California, or the West, I should say, than what you see in upstate New York. So what brought you to Los Angeles? Was it just practical reasons, or did you just find the, for instance, career change, or was it more along the lines of you like the culture better out here?
It was more along the lines of the culture and the weather. The weather, for sure. Utica, New York, is known for being so cold and so much snow. I swear to God, it snows like 10 months out of the year. From like as early as October to as late as May, it'll be snowing. Mm-hmm. But for me and my father, actually, he moved out here. I was about 2 years old or so, and both my parents moved out here because my father was in the tech industry, and there's really no tech industry, especially in the 80s in New York. So he came to California, and my mother was with him, and I was with him. But then they had a fight. My mom, they got divorced. My mother went back to New York and took me with her, and he stayed in California. So once I was about maybe 7 or 8 years old, I started flying from New York to California for my summer vacations. And every year I was out here, and I feel like there was no chance of me staying in New York after that, that I just wanted to be in California because, you know, we have everything here. Not to turn this into a California appreciation podcast, but let me go ahead and turn it into a California appreciation podcast.
We have the wildfires. We have the earthquakes. We have water shortages.
Yes.
It's a great, there's no state in the country probably where you can be outdoors and be more comfortable being outdoors. What a lot of people don't realize about California is we don't get the humidity and we don't mm-hmm. have all those insects eating you alive while you sit outside.
I know.
Or play outside.
In Southern California, we're getting more mosquitoes and people are like freaking out about that mosquitoes are turning into this huge thing. And this is like,
we're getting more up here too. Yeah. In Northern California, we're getting more too. It's terrible.
It is. And I remember growing up, you couldn't be outside because of the constant mosquitoes, especially during the summertime. And now we're just like, oh my God, this is not the way California does it. Where are these mosquitoes coming from? Those are the true immigrants we need to be angry about are the mosquitoes.
Yeah. Well, I just read, Smithsonian just published an article, not to get off track here, but they just published an article about genetically modified mosquitoes, all male mosquitoes that when they reproduce, they're going to basically start killing off mosquitoes, but also producing mosquitoes that don't sting. Mm. They don't bite. So, let's just hope it works.
Yeah.
Let me have you read a little bit because, I'm sure a lot of listeners haven't read The Woman in Red or Antoinette's Sister. Which one are you going to read from, first of all, and give us a little setup for it?
Well, I'm going to read from Antoinette's Sister today. And
give us a little synopsis of the book. Go ahead and tell our listeners what the book is about, and then go ahead and sure. kind of set up your excerpt.
Sure. So Antoinette's Sister is a story about Maria Carolina Charlotte. She was a Habsburg archduchess. Her mother was Maria Theresa, who ruled the Holy Roman Empire, which was where is now Austria and parts of Germany and the Eastern European area. And she was one of 16 children. And her next youngest sister was the famed Marie Antoinette that we all know how mm-hmm. her life famously ended. And with Maria Carolina Charlotte, it's a story of, the history from her perspective, the history of the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies and her struggles of being a queen with this king who was just completely inept and unable to really truly be a king. And so the scene that I'm going to go ahead and read from is in chapter 38. And this is after her mother has passed, that's not really a spoiler. It's historical fiction. People die.
Nobody in this book is left alive. Let's put it that way.
Exactly. And so this is her first time returning home to the palace that she grew up in after her mother's passing. So you ready?
Yes, okay. Fire away.
The family broke off from Leopold and me as we made our way to Mother's study. Her room may have been small, but its impact was felt throughout the country. Leopold opened the door and allowed me to step through. My fingers followed the curve of the wood inlay of pumpkins whose blue vines adorned with blossoms snaked up the wall up to the ceiling. I let my fingers trace the frames of the sketchings, each one in the blue and yellow white that matched the walls. They depicted lovely picnic scenes, which Mother most surely didn't have time to enjoy. They called this the porcelain room, but unlike porcelain, this room was inhabited by a woman whose will would not break. I made my way to the far side of the room where her desk sat, the same yellow-white as the rest of the room, next to a window overlooking the grounds below. Outside, birds chirped, and the leaves were turning from yellow to orange to brown. I placed my hand on top of the desk, my palm caressing the smooth surface. Hot tears pricked my eyes anew. Then I realized that all her papers were gone. She was gone. Closing my eyes, I tried to conjure her, the fragrant rose perfume that trailed behind her wherever she went, filling the room so all we could breathe was her, the gravity of her, the way she pulled us all in. I wanted to see my mother again, not the one from the portraits. No, the real Maria Teresa, the way her double chin wobbled when she laughed, her eyes, the subtle way they would squint as she considered the facts of a story, her warmth. Her hands were always warm. God, how I would take so much pride in her placing a warm, thick hand upon my head to hear her say one more time, I am proud. And that's it.
Well, you are a sensual writer.
Oh, thank you.
Place and time and all that. I'd expect nothing less because of the subject matter, because of your background, your heritage, very sensual writing. And funny to hear about the double chin wobbling as she laughed.
Well, that was one of the things with her where it's like, she was, I mean, you had 16 children. She enjoyed food, as many of us do. But those are some of those characteristics that you don't really get from a portrait that you would otherwise get from a real life woman.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. So talk about how you write. What is your routine? Are you get up in the morning, you have your coffee, you do a breathing exercise, and then you start writing? Are you an evening writer? What's your routine?
I feel like I do my best writing in the evenings. And I feel a lot of that is because when I was writing The Woman in Red, which was my debut, I was still working and I'd gone from that crappy travel agency to becoming a paralegal because I needed a job that was going to pay the bills. And you never know really when a career in writing will start, if there's going to be one that's going to be fruitful enough to be able to make a career of it long term on its own. And so I decided to become a paralegal so that I could at least pay the bills. And yeah, I was writing for a job too, because I was writing wills and trusts. So there was very technical writing that I was dealing with. And I feel like that's also gone forward in helping me with my writing, because every word had to be placed properly on the page because it's legal writing. And so I would write during my lunch breaks. You know, I'd have a notebook and I'd jot down scenes and whatnot for about hours. So those were my big writing sprints. And then I would come home and I would kind of self-edit and put it into the computer in the evening and then continue on for the rest of the evening. And so I've kind of gotten to this habit of my best writing is done in the evening.
You had to have been fatigued in the evening. And a lot of times people won't write when they're tired. But I do know that Gail Godwin said, she would say, write when you're tired. One of her pieces of advice would be write when you're tired because it lets your guard down and it tends to make your editor, your internal censor, kind of step back a little bit.
Yeah.
It's almost like this is the best I can do given the circumstances. So you write when you're fatigued. I mean, did you feel fatigued or were you always energized by sitting down to write in the evenings?
A little bit of both, because there were times where I did fall asleep at the computer. That did happen. I'm not going to lie. There were times I'd fall asleep like halfway through a sentence and I wake up and I'm like, oh, wait, what was I writing again? So there were those evenings. And so that is great advice because that does happen. And it's even better, much healthier advice as opposed to the whole write drunk, edit sober advice that so many of us like to follow. And so I would do that. And But I think feel like also with getting home, I was also kind of energized because I had this terrible commute. And it was an hour in LA traffic to get home from my job. And so I would have a soundtrack, either an audiobook going or a soundtrack. I had a soundtrack for my book. And I would have either of those things going. And if I had the soundtrack, which oftentimes in the evenings I would have the soundtrack going, I would be thinking about the story. It would get the images going. It would get my head going about the story. And then I would get home and I would put those into the book itself. And so that really helped me and energized me and bring it back to the writing.
So wait a minute. Let me understand this. So you're saying that you had a soundtrack, you had
yes.
music.
Mm-hmm.
That you had listened to while writing that mm-hmm. always brought you back to the kind of the ambiance or the mood or mm-hmm. the, wow, I've never heard of that before. How interesting. So tell me about the soundtrack. What, is it new age style music? Is it piano, jazz piano? What kind of soundtrack?
It's a mix. It would be songs that kind of helped inspire me for the story. Like I actually have links to it on my website, which it's my name, DianaGiovanazzo.com, not to be, you know, too inserting of my...
we all need to promote ourselves. Who else is going to do it, right?
Exactly. And so it's a Spotify soundtrack, and it's like I have the ex-ambassadors on there, and there's a song called Renegade. There's an L. King song on there. America's Sweetheart was another one of the songs for the
woman. So these are songs with lyrics.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So they're not just instrumental songs. Mm-hmm. So you're able to do that without getting distracted or picking up a refrain and putting it in your book.
Because it would get me, it would help with the emotions. Like it would help pull up the emotions, and those emotions would help me pull up the stories and the scenes I want to depict. And it didn't, I don't want to necessarily say I was daydreaming while I was in the car, because that's kind of dangerous. But at the same time, when you're in that stop and go traffic, you're still, your mind's going and it has to go somewhere.
Yes.
So otherwise you're mm-hmm. going to go nuts. And it's, that really helped me get into the mood and the setting for the story. And when I did the Antoinette Sister, I had a variation of songs. I had some, it's traditional Italian songs on there. The Vitamin String Quartet, they do a lot of covers of popular songs in classical style. And so I pulled in a lot of that in for that story, along with just other pop songs. I've got a Miley Cyrus song on there, Mother's Daughter.
So if, again, just to kind of nail this down, you're using a music soundtrack, and how did you word it? The music soundtrack would do what for you again?
It would
take
you
to that place.
Yeah, it would bring up those conjure those emotions. It would help me set the emotional scene for myself. It would bring me back to where I want to be for the writing. And I feel like for me, when I sit down to write, having that that soundtrack is so important to be able to get writing and to get myself into that. Okay, I'm going to sit down and write my 1,000 words. You know, going back to the NaNoWriMo, having that as the background, you know, doing 1,600 words a day, which is what you end up doing during the month of November, isn't necessarily sustainable. But doing 1,000 words a day or 500 words a day, that's something practical that you can do. And so to get myself into the, okay, this is my mind's going to go and my body's going to go and sit down and write this for, you know, however long it takes to get these 1,000 words out, the soundtrack helps kind of put my mind into
yeah.
that position.
It's like breaking a sweat for the workout mm-hmm. right off the bat. You've broken the sweat. Your body's warmed up right off the start. I mean, I'm using a physical analogy mm-hmm. rather than an emotional one. Or mental one. So yeah, that's, like I said, I've never heard of that before, but it sounds like a great idea. Mm-hmm. Is that an original, or did you pick that up from anybody, or did you just discover it by doing it?
I started just doing it, just because I wanted to have that in the car with me as I was driving. And then I started learning other authors do it. I know Alyssa Palumbo, she does that a lot with her writing. and other authors have talked about doing it as well. She was the first one I knew that actually shared it with other people. And I thought that was really cool. So I'm going to share it too.
Yeah, no, it's a great idea and one that I've never used myself. I think I want to give that a try. I'm the kind of person who probably wouldn't want the lyrics going on, but there's so much instrumental music. I love instrumental music anyway. So interesting. So what is a, let's go back to, oh God, help me with the shortened. Is it not NaNoWriMo?
NaNoWriMo, yes.
Yeah. When you had to churn out 1600 words a day, how different was your writing at that time? I mean, you obviously had to just produce, but you didn't want junk. I mean, anybody can just run their fingers over the keyboard and say there's 1600 words. How different was your writing when you were forcing yourself to produce 1600 versus a typical day where it might be 250, 500, 750?
It was freeing in a lot of ways, I found, because the story that I did two stories with NaNoWriMo that I haven't published because, and I don't think, I love the time period and the setting of it, but I feel like the stories that I did just aren't quite right. But doing it was a great exercise because it was freeing where it's like, okay, I've got 1600 words. I'm just going to write what comes to mind. I'm going to write all these backstory points, all of these other avenues of the story that you would think, okay, this isn't, you know, part of the story that I want to write, but I'm going to put this in here anyway. I'm going to spend about 500 words on scene setting just because. And so I feel like it really just kind of helps, you know, with that whole exploration of your writing.
Isn't that part of the whole purpose of it is to break through, to just produce and allow yourself to write instead of sitting there being critical of everything that's coming off the fingertips?
Exactly. And I feel like a lot of people kind of look at it as, okay, I've got these 50,000 words. I'm going to go take this and go ahead and publish it. But it really is, I feel like the best use of NaNoWriMo is to use it as an exercise in writing and in getting yourself to write and getting past that whole inner critic.
Yes. Yeah. So did it accelerate completion of your novel? Were you writing a novel at the time and it accelerated the completion of it? Or was it more that it created kind of that mindset or showed you some possibilities that weren't really?
It created the mindset. That's where it helped me. Because when I finished the first draft of The Woman in Red, it was in September of, I want to say 2016 or so, that I finished that first draft. And I was like, you know, I'm going to take a break. I'm going to step away from this draft. I'm going to spend the month of October doing research and planning. And then November, I'm going to write this other book. And I did that. And it kind of gave me this nice, fresh break and of writing in Anita's world, in the world of The Woman in Red. And then I came back to The Woman in Red after the holidays and just kind of just truly just tackled it after that. And I feel like every year, if it does line up that I can do it, I'll go back to NaNoWriMo and do that as an exercise for myself.
So it changed your attitude or maybe even the writing process a little bit. It's been good for you.
Yes.
Obviously. So what's a good day of writing for you now? I mean, what qualitatively or quantitatively, however you want to measure it, what is a good day of writing for you?
Hitting the 1,000 words, I feel like is a good writing day.
So it's important to have the quantity. If you're not in what is, does that quantity depend on? Do you have certain days where I won't say writer's block, because I don't think it necessarily means there's some blockage there, except that maybe the ideas are coming more slowly or what have you. I mean, what would you say about that?
There are some days where it's like pulling teeth just to try to be able to get the words down. And I feel like on those days, that's important where I'm like, okay, it's not going to happen today, where there's something at least right now, there's something wrong with the story.
You keep going? Do you keep going? Or are you the kind of writer who says, I'm wasting my time right now and I'm discouraging myself, so I'm just going to cut this short right now and I go back at it tomorrow or later in the day?
I do. Yeah, the second, the latter. I step back and I say, okay, I'm going to go ahead and do some more research. In my podcast, we had Shari Capri on once, and we were talking about writer's block. And at least from the historical fiction perspective, she was like, I always found when it's quote unquote writer's block, that it's a matter of, I just need to go back and do some more research. I need to go pick up some more history and read some more of that. And I found that to be very, very true for myself with my writing as well, where it's like, okay, if I'm having problems with the story, if I'm not finding a good start for this, I need to step back and go do some more research. Go look at, read something along the lines of the story. And if there is no other research, if I'm doing something completely fictional where I already have, I don't need necessarily the research, I'll go read something else. I'll give my mind a break. I know Diana Galbadon has also talked about this as well, where even if you're not writing, you're still in your mind writing. You're still paying attention to story, whether you're watching a movie or television show, or you're reading another book, or just sometimes just staring into space. You're still, your brain's doing this stuff in the background that you need to be able to do a story.
You're still on a project, you're still on task. It's like an incubator. It's almost like in an incubator.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It continues, or a greenhouse. Things are still happening, even if you can't see them or consciously know they're happening. There's growth going on there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. If you're just sitting in your backyard watching a bird hop from branch to branch to branch, that watching that movement, watching that happen, that can be put into a story.
You extrapolate from everything in life,
exactly.
But it depends on being very much being wed to the project, having it in the back of your mind. It really requires, I mean, there's a lot of people who are big advocates of write every day. If you don't write every day, it's not real fresh. It's not in progress, really. And when it's in progress, that's when what you're talking about happens. Here's a bird, you know, bouncing from branch to branch. I'm writing about something entirely different, but I can extrapolate from what's going on there, and it actually turns into content.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I was one of those people who was like, okay, you've got to write every single day. And I will try to write every single day. If you can, that's great. But if you think about it being like a 9-to-5 kind of situation, are you going to want to work at your job, whatever job you have, 7 days a week? No, you're going to need a break. You're going to need to take a couple days sometimes to be able just to get your bearings, just to rest, to let your brain rest. And we need to think about
it. Are you still working a job?
No.
Are you still working? Okay, so you write, full time.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you write full time now. That must be a real luxury.
It is. It is. It's a luxury and a stressor sometimes too. I'm able to write full time primarily because my husband works full-time as well. He's got another job. So we're able, you know, the things like insurance, I don't have to worry about insurance.
So he's got you covered.
Yeah.
What's the stressful part? Is it because you have all this time that you put greater expectations on yourself?
No, I think the more, once you're in the place where you're able to make some money off of your writing, it's okay. You're in this position where you don't have a steady income coming in. So it's like, okay, this advance ends at, you know, this amount of time, because this is what's paying for the mortgage. So, all right, I got to try to sell something before that mortgage, next mortgage payment. That sort of thing is what goes through your mind, because you're dealing with, you know, this unsteady income. And before, when you have a steady 9-to-5 job, you've got this steady income that's always going to be there, where it's like, okay, I don't have to worry about this, you know, unsecured income that's going to be dependent upon me producing. I've got something else over here that's going to be constantly producing. So I feel like that's the biggest stressor now versus when I had a full-time job.
Hmm. So why do you write at all? Because for most people, writing is torture. If you go to somebody at a job and you say, I like that idea, but I want you to write it up. I write it as a report. people hate to write. It's torment. And yet there's millions of people like you and me who do write. We love to write. But what do you actually get out of the writing from an emotional standpoint?
I feel like when it comes to writing in and of itself, it's the only way I can understand the world. Being able to put, you know, pen to paper is just really how I make sense of things, how I make sense of what's going on around me, whether it's history, present day, future. It's writing. Writing is where I make sense of the world. And I feel like that's really the only thing that comes to my mind with it. And where you have this impulse where it's like, okay, I've got to keep writing. If I'm not writing a book, I've got my own journals that I write. I'm studying Italian, so I'm trying to now actually write in Italian, which probably is a lot, very close to kindergarten squirrel, if I'm being honest with myself here. And then I have my own journals. So it's having, just being able to write every single day, it's always going to be there. It's always this constant from the time, for as long as I can remember, I was making up stories. And I swear one day I'm going to die with a pen in my hand. Because that's
the best way to go.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
For a writer, that's the best way to go. I mean, we all have our date with destiny. It might as well be doing something that we love and something that is making sense of the world and making sense of the other world. Mm-hmm. You know, what you said, I love what you said. Joan Didion said something similar. She says, I don't know what I think about anything until I write about it. Mm-hmm. Very, very similar in that, you know, we really kind of suss out our feelings about things when we take the time to actually write. I used to work for a guy who, this was at a newspaper company I worked for, and he used to say, there's no problem you can't write your way out of, which is another way of looking at writing, that it solves problems. And in fact, you know, kind of what you're talking about is solution to a problem, because we all want to make sense of the world, certainly our own personal world, and, you know, how we think and comport ourselves and so on. What is next for Diana G?
Oh, gosh. You know, I can't really.
Now, I know you got a project going, and I know that you tell us what you can tell us about it. For example, how far along are you? Is it set in Italy? Is it a historical novel?
It is a historical novel. It is set in Italy. And it's pretty much all I can say. I'm so sorry. I know.
Well, how far along are you?
It's at the point where it's in the second draft editing phase right now.
Oh, okay. So are you doing the editing, or your editor's doing the editing right
now? I'm letting somebody do the editing for me right now. Okay. For that.
And this was this on on deadline? Are you under contractual deadline?
No, I'm not for this one.
Okay. So when will we see it hit the market? Do you anticipate? I know that's hard to say because the publishing company has more to say.
Yet. That's one of the reasons why I can't really talk about it, because it's not sold yet.
You have a title, and I'm not going to ask you to give us the title, but I'm curious whether you have a title.
I have a title.
Did you have it before you started?
Yes. Sometimes you have them before you start, and that's always so fascinating. Like The Woman in Red, I had before I started it, or at least right after I started it. And then for this next one, I had it right before I started it. And Antoinette's Sister actually was the only one where I just did not have a title. And I went back and forth with my publisher multiple times, going through multiple differences with the title. Originally, it was going to be The Neapolitan Queen. But because of marketing...
Like Elena Ferrante ruined that for you.
Well, that would have made it more popular, in my opinion. But because of...
Well, that's true. That's true. You could have grabbed her coattails, sure.
Exactly. I have no problems doing that. because of Marie Antoinette's, we grabbed onto those coattails and we went with Antoinette's Sister so that people would have that connection with Marie Antoinette.
So how important... I mean, I'm working on one right now where I had the title right from the start. I knew it. I love the title. It's one word. And it almost serves as a driving force for me. how do you find that to be the case at all? Do you feel like it's important to have the title in advance, or do you prefer that it reveals itself during the writing? Do you have any feelings about that?
Sometimes, you know, for the two that had the titles right from the start, like The Woman in Red, it came really quickly. And so that was a very much driving force, because The Woman in Red, it has so many different layers to it, because you have this woman who's out there on a battlefield and you think red and blood and fighting and all of that. But yet also with Garibaldi, his regiment was known as the Red Shirts. And she was the unknown figure within those Red Shirts. And that really spoke to that as well. And so that really helped kind of drive the story forward and developing the character. But at the same time, you know, if you're going to go with a traditional publishing route, you have this name for this book and it's like, yeah, this is a great name. And the publisher's like, yeah, no, we want something else. The marketing people get involved and it's a whole nother story.
Start focus grouping it. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
So there you go. So let's talk about, in closing, let's have you give the aspiring writers out there, whether they're aspiring or they've already published something, but you know, it's always a constant battle to stay inspired mm-hmm. and to always look for good advice. So what would your advice be to other novelists?
To read everything. From the bag of shampoo bottles to the classics, just everything you can get your hands on, read it.
What happens when you do that?
It's the best teacher, I feel like, when it comes to writing. When you're reading, you get to see how other people do things, how you get a natural feel for pacing of a novel, character development, all of those sorts of things. And, you know, writing courses and whatnot, they can tell you, you know, the basic grammar, how grammars are done. They can give you the chart of this is how conflict works and this is how a story arc should work. But to really see that in action, the only way you can see that is through writing and the various types. You know, I write historical fiction and I read a lot of historical fiction, but I still go back to fantasy and I read fantasy. I'll read literary fiction, crime thrillers, whatever I can get my hands on, I'll read. And that's mm-hmm. the only way to know what it is that you like, what it is that you don't like. And reading outside of the genre that you write also kind of helps influence your writing. And you know, not just the overall market,
exactly,
but how it, you know, different elements of that. Yeah, it diversifies your writing itself.
It diversifies your writing. Yeah. I will just interject here that when I was a writing and reporting coach for the publishing company I worked for previously, one of the things I would tell them, because it were business publications, mm-hmm. but I talk about how if you read business publications, you see the common phrases, the cliches, the common phrases and analogies and so on. But if you read sports reporting mm-hmm. and you read science reporting and you read entertainment writings like Us Weekly and People Magazine, Entertainment Magazine, you pick up phrasing and you diversify your phrasing mm-hmm. and you find new analogies to use in business instead of sounding like everybody else. So you pull from that. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly really what you were talking about. It mm-hmm. makes so much sense. And I think too often people, if they're writing detective novels, they're just reading detective novels and that's it. Well, you want to swim outside your own pool.
Exactly.
At least some of the time for yes. that reason. So I'm really glad that you gave a piece of advice like that, because I think too often people just say, just keep at it. Keep at it. Well, yeah, keep at it. But how do I enrich the experience of keeping at it? What? Give me a tool I can use, that sort of thing.
Yes, that's why I say reading, it, even the back of shampoo bottles, it's you're reading something. Read, you know, the technical stuff. Reading that, everything helps. Everything you read helps you.
Yeah. You know, one more example I'll give is I knew a guy who was a direct response marketing writer. And he said, you know, I walked in this ice cream parlor one day and the gal behind the counter said, I want you to know that this particular ice cream is not available right now. And he said, there was something about the phrase, I want you to know. And he said, and I grabbed onto that. And that's what I started. This is direct response marketing. So mm-hmm. you're trying to appeal to people, grab their attention, and actually motivate them to action and so on. And it's just another example. And again, mm-hmm. we were talking earlier about extrapolation. We can extrapolate from anywhere, really, because it all in one way or another can apply to writing, because writing is, it has no boundaries, mm-hmm. really has no boundaries. Mm-hmm. So Diana, thank you for taking the time. I, you know, you could be writing your, you know, 1600 words today or your 1,000 words today, but you took time to share yourself with us. I really appreciate you coming on the program.
Thank you so much for having me. It was such a pleasure.